Hello. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, David, for your reading, Haunting. I tell students, I see some in the audience here, and I have a little joke, which is not a joke, that if you're doing a graduate PhD and you finish without having a nervous breakdown, you haven't done the work. So... And the only reason I can laugh about this is because I actually had a psychotic episode when I was working on my PhD at UC Berkeley. And I actually credit, if that's an oxymoron, David Merritt for a large part of that. I'm happy because I'm making money off it. It's part of the new memoir. But it wasn't a joke back in 2000. What had happened is Jared Sexton had been talking to me he's another critical theorist who's been very influential. And he was saying, let's think the structural antagonism through anti-blackness. And I was a so-called expert on Negre and Gramsci. And I just, had been doing political education workshops for the Communist Party in South Africa. I had no idea, what the hell is he talking about? And he gave me this book, which you should read, called On Black Men. And it was so disturbing that it just simply catalyzed all the other shit that was happening in my life. And I found myself at the Tang Center across the bay here. And for the next year, I was on like uppers and downers, But there's a line in there which is, what do you do with an unconscious that appears to hate you? And that was the line that had really stumped me, in addition to the rest of the book. So, and I can see how this is manifest in the poetry itself. All right, I could talk all night about David Merritt. I've taught that book once or twice a year since it came out, but I won't. I'm going to start off with a very short poem called Survivor. Last night the sea belched without wiping its mouth, as though it had leave to tame mercy with a life in one color. I'm dealing with loss. If there can be such a thing as black mourning, that's another thing that David has brought me to think about. But my mother died recently. And what was interesting about that relationship was that she was a major influence on me, in that watching her and my father become educated formally and write dissertations and articles kind of weaned me in that direction. And the intensity with which parents, especially black middle-class parents, I would imagine, put so much energy into the formation of their first child. And that's not always a thing that makes for a happy household. So what I'm trying to say is that for a good 40 years from, starting with 1968, my mother and I were politically and ideologically at odds, but at the same time, she was one of the greatest intellectual influences in my life. I think the dedication to, in this new book, I can't remember exactly how I put it, but it's one is to my wife, Anita Wilkins, and the other is to my parents for teaching me the value of an intellectual life. And so we just argued over the plight of black people and our attitude towards this country for many years. But then about 10 years ago, when I was about 53, my mother came to California, and she said, "What are you working on?" I said, "It's a new book." And I knew that, given my hatred for this country and her sense that it can improve, we were going to get into one of our wars again. But she said, "I'd like to see it." So, and the manuscript had come back edited, but not in galley form. And I took a risk, and I showed it to her. I gave it to her, and when I got to pick her up, Anita and I went to the hotel the next day to pick her up. She had the manuscript pages spread out around the room, and she'd been reading them and true to her form, marking places where the editor had missed and stuff like that. But instead of getting into an argument about the unflinching paradigmatic analysis of the book that basically shit on the inspiration of this country, she actually said, "I'm proud of you." And that was a real turning point in our lives because, you know, I never became a Roman Catholic and she never came to the left of the Communist Party, but we spent the next 10 years being able to tell each other that we were pleased and proud of what we were doing in life. And that was something that I never thought would actually happen. So this is a poem. I'm going to read two poems that are inspired and about her. One is called Meant for the Neighbors. When we lived in Kenwood, in an all-white neighborhood in Minneapolis, I had a rash of wetting the bed in the fifth grade, and my mind shut down, and I basically was going to flunk out of the fifth grade from having been told that I should skip from fourth to sixth just the year before. And so I think it was my mom getting me to exercise in the morning and keeping the fact that I was wetting the bed from my brothers and sisters and just getting me going that actually helped me to complete the fifth grade and go on. This is called Meant for the Neighbors. I survived childhood on quotations from film stars and Chairman Mao. A monk with malachite beads, I clenched the words of others. But of this graceless lurch through white grammar schools, was it Stevenson or Poe I pledged to memory and took to my mother? Before a man dies, he must write a book, love a woman, and kill a man. She eyed me as though I was a parcel intended for the neighbors. You mean, what does it mean? No, I mean, is it true? We were alone. The window was open. The drapes were still refusing to explain why she looked away. So we were taught to be good kids and not to, my mother thought I was wayward and a hothead. And basically she lived in a situation in which from 62 to about 65, a good 3 years, the people in the whole neighborhood didn't even speak to her. I remember there was a lot of inherited money in this neighborhood. And I remember in 1968, we were about to go away on one of my dad's sabbaticals where my mom was going to study for her field research in child development. My both parents ended up opening an office in where there was a clinical psychologist together. And my dad taught and my mom was principals of schools in the daytime. And this white woman down the street who had never finished college and had just was living off this inherited money asked my mother, you know, what she was doing. And she says, "Well, I'm going back for my PhD. And the woman said, "Oh, you poor thing. I'm so glad I'm free, white, and 21. I can remember my mom dragging me up the street by the hand and being so angry. But she didn't show it. And then something happened which really shocked me. When Martin Luther King was killed, she and my dad, but I only thought it was her at the time, wrote an angry letter to all the people in that neighborhood. And remember, there's no like Xerox machines, there's no internet, and we actually delivered those letters, hand-delivered them. A reporter called me the other night to write an obituary that's coming out in the Minneapolis Tribune probably tomorrow. And she had actually found the newspaper article which had republished this entire letter with, you know, some little safe framing from the editors. And I had never seen this letter, so I'm reading this. I wrote this poem based upon my memory of that experience with her. It's called Civil Rights. Mother never spoke of slavery. She was born and raised in a debutante ball. But when they killed Dr. Martin Luther King, she wrote every blue hair, blonde eye a letter. Like any spring of no reply, winter was late in leaving, and we were her only postage, my sister and I, walking end to end through the seep of slush and the push of wind. No one dabbed a crystalled eye, for she would have no crying. this next poem is called Chronicle, and it's written in about, 4 stanzas. And it really talks about 4 periods in my life, in our family's life, when I was 2 years old, 6 years old, 8 years old, and 12 years old. So at 2 years old, it's 1958, and this is a time when we're leaving the South to first go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where my parents will go to grad school. And then 6 years old is the time when we move to Minneapolis and the horrors of living in this all-white, so-called wealthy enclave kind of creep in on me. And the rest of the poem is about that also. So I start each stanza with 2, 6, 8, and 12. Chronicle. They smile, tip their hats, lower their shotguns, and let us cross the Mississippi line. Legs dangling from the pickup in front, I don't recall. The guns mom remembers dad doing the nothing he could do. Up north, he'll make a career of it. 6. For Halloween, I washed my face and wore my school clothes. Went door to door as a nightmare. 8. At night, Dad builds a fire, feeds it with my clippings. Castro on parade. Why does my penis stick out more than most? He stares at the rug where embers fall. Lose some weight, it'll go back in. Flags, nations, armies, lots of people get aroused. 12. My sister is 6 and we don't like her. Too cute, too seldom beaten. We're glad her hair's a nappy nigger mess. Mom hides it with a wig. We snatch that wig right off. She rolls in the dirt, holding her head. We stand above her, satisfied as stormtroopers. These poems are mainly about my father. So my dad lived across the new museum that was made for the new slavery museum on the Mississippi River in 2014. I can't remember. I didn't go. Anyway, I can see people searching for it in their minds. But anyway, he comes from a community right across the river, and his people, I understand, were slaves on the White Castle plantation. There are about 450 plantations between New Orleans and Baton Rouge on that stretch of land. And my mother comes from the city of New Orleans, which, so there was a class difference between them. And this is mainly about my father. Arrival. I drive north along the river, past cane, corn, inland oceans of wheat, away from a place where my grandfather gave his son shoes, that he might lose his accent and marry my mother. A child kept in school during the harvest, he opened his face to words. A cowbird on a fence post says, "It's true, all true, as long as you get there first," then flies through a hole in my rearview mirror. This next poem is called In Here. And there have been 2 really uncanny moments in my life where I've actually literally for one instant seen my dad in places where he wasn't. One time in 1980, I was on a bus from Tangier to Casablanca, and it stopped at a roadside place, and my dad was sitting right on the edge of a market stall. And I literally called out to him. And the woman I was traveling with actually said also, "That's your dad, you know." And then I got off the bus, and of course it wasn't him, that's the end of the story. I don't know what it means. Or people are looking at me like this is going somewhere. I don't know where it's going, except that was about 1982. And then it happened again in 1998 in Havana, Cuba, where I was on this 6-week trip with Global Exchange, living in Verdado, and then he walks into the courtyard and starts speaking Spanish. And as the light was bad, but as soon as he walked deeper into the light, I realized that it wasn't him. So there were actually, you know, two moments on international travel where I actually ran into him. Same hair, same facial features, the gait, way of sitting, the slender body. It was kind of freaky. So after the second time it happened in Cuba, I wrote this poem called In Here. Into my courtyard came a man intoxicated with sadness, and no more use for my name than the names of plants in the yard. Lizard tracks lined his face, drawn thin as wrists, drawn thin as the last rail of garden sculpture, unfinished. The eyes forgotten as well the humility of hands, one curled to a fist for knocking at the gate, one held open for permission. Through room after room of astonishment, his palms empty of gratitude, pushed. What do you want? We rocked on the stone veranda. Where are you from? The eyes with nothing gave it all. Where do you live? In here with illusions. So I spent time in South Africa, as Steve said. The book Incognito oscillates between the United States, Kenwood, and Northern California, and then South Africa, and it keeps oscillating. The structure of it keeps oscillating back and forth until we come to the end, which is my return. And I'm not going to go into too much of that because you can buy the book. But toward the end of the apartheid era, after Chris Hani, the head of Umkhonto weSizwe, was assassinated, actually before that happened, Nelson Mandela gave the order for all the clandestine units to stand down and to go to arms caches and dig them up and give them to some kind of neutral commission. I don't remember. Anyway, I was with a group of people who refused to do that. And Hani and the people in the high command had identified targets to be hit as upper-level ANC executives were being assassinated, sometimes directly by the police and sometimes through contra forces of the Inkatha Freedom Party. And Mandela was very much against this order, and so there was a lot of tussle back and forth between that. So two people who were at a place where I taught, one was my student in comparative literature and the other was in the School of Social Work, were part of a unit that had recruited me. And when Hani was assassinated, they attempted to assassinate Gay Darby Lewis, who was the head of the Conservative Party, who actually pulled the money together to hire the Polish shooter and make her husband the fall guy also. When nothing came of this, in other words, what we thought would happen was that lumpen proletariats and other disaffected people not aligned to the moderates in the ANC would spark something that would rally people to not only agitate against the apartheid state, but agitate against the compromises that the ANC was making in terms of political economy. Simultaneously to this happening, Nelson Mandela began to call in field commanders as well as people in COSATO and mid-level executives in the ANC and warned them in this period from April 10th, 1993 to about April 20th that were you to instigate any of these types of actions to bring this into a revolutionary dispensation as opposed to a compromise, that you will not have a job or a place in the military in the new ANC. And so the people that I was associated with were students, and they didn't give a rat's ass. So they went out and tried to retaliate against Gay Darby Lewis by bombing the Conservative Party headquarters. It was a botched attempt because the grenades that they launched actually hit a grate and dribbled back down and exploded in their face and arms. And so eventually it looked like nothing was going to happen that would challenge the compromise that the ANC was making. And so the person I call Trevor in the book, and Jabu, took their student IDs and they went back to the Conservative Party headquarters and where they had bombed, and they put their IDs in the headquarters so that they could be captured and tortured and emerge as above ground political activists, which they were not before. I know it's a loopy logic, but there's an essence of time here. So this is for them. It's called The Lucky Ones with Their Shadows. Sometimes in a country where torture is rife. Oh, one last thing, which is important to the poem. At the end of 6 weeks of torture, I met Trevor to go to a graduate student party for his return from the comparative literature department. Now, the comparative literature department students were all white. And at this party, they proceeded to get drunk, and he was white also, and tell him what a fool he was and how bad armed struggle was. And it was supposed to be a party of appreciation. And as they became intoxicated, they showed their true colors as white liberals who were not down with the revolution by any means necessary. So this is not only for them, but also, I mean, for Heinrich, his name is Heinrich and Tefu, but for a critique of the people at this particular party. I'll say more about this later if anyone wants to hear about it. The Lucky Ones with Their Shadows. Sometimes in a country where torture is rife, I think how lucky the school children whose denial is truly plausible, whose sleep is dependent on screams of what they may not become, a nostril punctured by a favorite math pencil, a vulva pinched with sharp tools from the floor of seventh grade, testes crushed by new teachers. Part pupils, part objects of pain, in rooms darkened with sunlight where they alone are the only students, sponging knowledge free of texts, the lucky ones. They may never know this fraternity of fragments, these dim and flickering lamps at night, truant in the streets, ensuring their future, their safe return. When I first got there in 89, the ANC was not unbanned. It was an illegal organization. Mandela and his people did a deal with de Klerk, which was to unban the ANC and make it a legitimate political party if Mandela's people kept the militants who were being trained in Cuba and Comic-Con out of the country until the exiles who were in London and Toronto and New York and Paris returned and could set up the ANC in the image of a kind of Western political party as opposed to setting up in the image of a revolutionary movement. And it was at this particular time from about 1990, well, actually, from the death of Hani to the end of 94, there were 350,000 card-carrying ANC members, and about 100 people were either purged actively. The story that doesn't get told is the amount of internecine violence that we experienced in this time period, or just left through disaffection. And so this poem called Nord Street kind of resonates with what I felt and what I experienced as an ANC office holder, aligned more with what was called the so-called ultra-leftists, as opposed to the people who wanted to bring in what was being touted as a mixed economy. This is called Nord Street. Nord Street is a train station in Johannesburg, and as I arrived, the Group Areas Act was ending. But there were still white entrances and black entrances. And by the black entrances, there were lots of market stalls where you could buy car parts or fruits and vegetables and catch black taxis to various parts of town because you couldn't ride meters taxis for a while. So Nord Street. Between the ashes of apartheid and what they say is coming are the merchant stalls of Nord Street Station, where a woman sells bruised fruit. Above the rock and tumble of trains, her feet hold down the earth. Her hands move over late mangoes and pears, turning each imperfection inward against the eye. It is July in Johannesburg. Winter, where from lampposts politicians wait for the wet oblivion of night. In the last seeds of daylight, I fill my bag with apple and guava, attempt nonchalance at the track of stitching under her eye. Say, as always, keep the change. This is not my country. For years, I marked my calendar by two seasons. Rain, when jacaranda petals bleed their purple hue into the soil, and not rain, when waiting for the season of rain. Now it's marked by days of abstinence from this face of scars, a spectacle for my optimism. For though I am aging, the face in my passport still lays claim to me upon demand and shares my unclipped skin. As dusk and the first lampposts flicker and choke like promises, I wonder which locomotive en route to which desert turned its steel into her cheek and tell her how I love the last fruit spoiled on my kitchen table. I'll read just two more. Another concept that came out of David Marriott's work was the problem of mourning Black death. And I won't go deeper into that. If you want to talk about it, he's here and can answer questions on it. But it's this poem in some way resonates with that particular issue as well as other things that come up in his work and the work of people like Sadia Hartman and Jared Sexton and Hortense Spillers, people who have been really, really formative with respect to my own thinking about these. And it also has to do with the ways in which, as I said the other night at San Francisco State, I find that creative writing workshops that even want to do multicultural work are really often unable to assist Black creative writers in thinking about the grammar of Black suffering in its singularity. There's always this hydraulics of trying to make it analogous to the grammar of suffering of other people of color. And I do not think that the slave dynamic actually has that kind of an analogy. So all of this is sedimented in this particular poem called The Convocation of Conquest. My chair was missing from the table, an oversight, I'm sure. Standing there, I considered the distance we'd walk just to arrive, and the horses, apathetic to the prey of their riders, gaining in spite of themselves, with heads so enormous, cold mist from their nostrils fell upon the moon, upon you and me, and the men and women we took with us from the corners of sleep. One dream, one table, one people with one unnameable loss, and no place set even aside. So I'll end with this poem called Law Abiding, which is basically sparked by, not by the rash of Black murders at the hands of enforcers of the state, but by the ways in which these things that have always been happening became part of our visual culture about 5 years ago. It's called Law Abiding. Don't slant the story to fit your needs. Bullets been catching hell from niggas long as I've been born. Like apples, okay, you got your few bad bullets, but most work hard and vote. Yes, they vote. Got wives and sweet kids in the clip. Who cradles them when a nigger vamps? Who says what to them? Mrs. Bullitt, I have some bad news. Then what? It's about your husband, Mr. John Frederick Bullitt. Or, may I call you Frida? Frida John Frederick passed this evening. Now, Frida, be strong, for unsavory are the details. He died in a nigger's spine. Crushed on impact. Now, Frida, don't cry. The DA's on it, the judge has been briefed, and your husband's friends are in the streets. Thank you.